This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This session is the masterclass on organisation leadership. We've got two speakers for the session. We've got Jo Ellis and Martin Bradley. I'm going to introduce the first speaker first, and she's going to spend about half an hour, and she's hoping that it will be an interactive session between you, between herself and yourself. So she'll be asking some questions and obviously inviting comments back from you guys. Jo is a research fellow at the Health Management Centre at the University of Birmingham. Her main research interests are the areas of patient and public involvement. Jo is also interested in the issues of staff engagement and empowerment. And she has recently completed a project for the Nuffield Trust exploring the potential of employee ownership models and how this can be adapted in the NHS title. So her title for her in the NHS and the title of presentation is Employee Ownership Within the NHS. And I welcome Jo.
Yes. Excellent. Brilliant. Thank you. Thanks, Guy. There we are. When I was invited to do this session, I was invited to do a workshop, and I always think of a workshop as something where you kind of roll up your sleeves and you've got lots of tables and we're in a theatre-style lecture hall. So I've planned something potentially quite participatory, which I'm going to forge ahead with anyway, because I'm always sort of enthused to do something like this. Just to give you a little bit of background, I want to talk about the issue of employee ownership within the NHS, but actually the starting point for the piece of work that I want to tell you about was perhaps the more fundamental issue, indeed the more fundamental issue of staff engagement. And you'll see, hopefully, that the kind of journey I'll take you through in the session as to why that's a particularly important starting point for looking at something such as employee ownership. What I want to do, as I said, is talk to you a little bit about, this is where I thought we'd have a smaller room and I could go, this report. I have some executive summary copies of the report, which I shall leave at the front desk if any of you are interested. As I said, I want to do something participatory. I have some questions for you, but also if you want to ask me any questions or make any comments as I'm going along, please feel free to do so. Okay, I just want to give you a little bit of context to this. I mean, we've seen a very changing and evolving policy agenda in the NHS now for well over a decade, but perhaps one of the most consistent features amongst all of that change has been the issue of staff engagement. And staff engagement has increasingly emerged as an explicit policy goal. In some ways, we can trace that goal back to at least probably 1999 when the NHS Task Force on Staff Involvement was set up. But that priority afforded to staff engagement has exploded in recent years, perhaps for quite obvious reasons, as we've seen this shift, in rhetoric at least, between a model of reform and improvement, which was based on top-down drivers, so targets and performance management, to a model which is based much more on bottom-up, staff-led reform and staff-driven reform. And of course then the issue of how you actually engage staff in the workplace becomes absolutely critical. Ministers call it a self-improving service, and I think the linchpin here in that self-improving service is the role of staff in terms of being able to drive forwards an improvement agenda and deliver the level of patient care they want to. And the final kind of piece in the jigsaw here in terms of context is recent research from previously the Healthcare Commission. This is Vina Rayleigh, the final point, is starting to demonstrate what we probably always thought was intuitively correct, which is organisations where staff are happy and have a good experience and well-being also have happy patients. So there's a fundamental issue here about staff engagement and staff well-being being critical also to patient experience and outcomes. So staff engagement is increasingly important. Indeed, we might argue it's the linchpin now. If we look at Darcy's work and if we look around the NHS constitution, it's seen as the linchpin for change in the NHS. And I just wanted to find out from you what you think about this. What do you think makes staff in your organisation feel engaged, or in your team or your colleagues? And how engaged do you feel in your job? So find a neighbour. Some of you might need to move a little bit. And I'm just going to give you a couple of minutes to think about that. Okay, I think I've given you a couple of minutes. Sorry to cut you short when there's a good level of noise in the room, which suggests you're deep in discussion and debate. But does anybody have any suggestions? And does anybody want to share the discussions they had with their neighbours? Oh, yes, Mark's going to come down to you.
Thank you. I think we said the main things are getting good lines of communication with channels, which is both ways, from the top and from the coalface, so that you know all ideas can be shared and then people will start to feel valued.
Okay, so there's lots in there, communication, yeah. Being valued, organisations kind of put, you talked about all levels of an organisation, yeah. So there's something about it working at every stage.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Oh.
Thank you.
And we talked about team meetings, local team meetings, so that everybody knows what's going on and making sure people feel valued and they will have their own jobs to do and people have their appraisals and so they know which way they're going and they know what the organisation's doing and they know where they fit in.
Okay.
The organisation.
So. Thank you. So some of the same sorts of things, but also about knowing where you fit within the organisation and what the organisation is moving towards and where and what part you play in all of that. Thank you.
Being valued and having some control over the way you work and having right. some input into policies and decision making and being valued as an employee with a contribution to make.
Okay,
thank you. Not having sweeping changes brought in and without proper explanation.
Right, so changes with you rather than imposed on you. And
yeah.
the key thing now I heard was about involvement in decisions, key decisions.
And control as well.
And control. Okay, thank you. Anybody else?
Hello, this one.
Oh, we've got
somebody
over here.
Thank you. It's a lady in red.
It'd be fit. Being honest, actually telling the staff what is really going on and asking for their opinions and how they can see changes that could be made. So often things are actually told to you rather than yeah. asking you how they can do it.
Yeah, okay, thank you. So very much echoing the previous comment about who's in control of those changes, who gets to shape them, and again, implications for decision making. Anybody else? Any different comments? Thank you.
I work in Sheffield Teaching Hospitals, and we've just had probably a month of staff engagement yeah. where on four occasions, at least 200 staff were expected to join in an open space event.
Okay.
And I think when they first started, the staff felt, you know, we're being made to go to this, and it was randomly picked, but it still meant that maybe two or three people from one area were going. So we got that rationalised, and people went. But the staff were thrown because they had to make the agenda themselves.
Right.
And so once they've agreed the agenda, then people who had more to say about car parking, for example, mm-hmm. or whatever, got together. My colleague here also had something similar, but we're still waiting for the results to come out, and they're really very keen that before Christmas they'll tell us what we're going to do about those issues,
okay.
which will be quite interesting. My colleague here has got a similar tale.
I think the staff engagement with my trust has been very different in the staff are very cynical about it.
Okay.
They do feel that it's been very much done unto them. We were taken off the premises to a different place where we had a Jeremy Kyle type presentation okay. of what we should be doing
right.
within the organisation. And I think a lot of the staff felt that, you know, the trust can say that they've ticked a box and engaged with us, but in the end, we didn't really feel that engaged, although we were there.
sounds quite one way, you know, it's very much engagement in the form of this is, we're telling you what you need to do. And I guess the cynicism in part perhaps comes from some of that, engagement being potentially a two-way process. Let me tell you a bit about what we know about staff engagement in the NHS. There's been quite a lot of research done on this. Some of the best, I think, by the Institute of Employment Studies based down at Sussex University. They've done research with over 10,000 NHS employees over a number of years. And they, there's a lot of background to this. I'm rather boiling down a big body of research. But they basically say that what engagement means to NHS staff can actually be boiled down to, and I heard lots of this, particularly in the front here, about being valued, is engagement for NHS staff is a sense of being valued and being involved. So what does that mean in practice, to be valued and involved? Well, they also looked at that. So they looked at, well, what are the specific drivers or things that lead you to be more likely to feel valued and involved? And there were four that came up as being absolutely critical. And again, I think these absolutely echo what some of the people in the room have shared with us. So that's involvement in decision-making, being able to share and take decisions about the organisation, about your team, about your own position. An ability to voice ideas, so to make suggestions, but the key part of that is to which managers listen. So you're heard as well. Somebody listens to those suggestions you make. Opportunities for employees to develop their jobs, and concern for employees' health and well-being. So they're the four key factors. So how does that match up to what we know about staff experience in the NHS? Unfortunately, it shows that there are quite a lot of gaps. If we're saying that staff engagement is absolutely critical to NHS reform, to staff well-being, to patient experience and outcomes, I think potentially we have quite a long way to go. So the overall issue of being valued, 33% of staff, this is the 2008 NHS staff survey, agreed with the statement, I'm satisfied with the extent to which, sorry, the text has come out rather funny here, the extent to which
it's quite effective actually, because the fact that there are gaps in the sentence.
Right.
Gaps in
the perception. Right. Yeah. Thank you. I'm satisfied with the extent to which my trust values my work. A third of people agreed with that statement. So involvement in decisions, one of those four key drivers. So the top point, 29% of people felt that senior managers tried to involve staff in important decisions. Suggesting new ideas to which managers listen. 36% agreed that senior managers encourage staff to suggest new ideas for improving services. And number three, opportunities to develop in the job. And that's that final one. Only 40%, or just under 40%, agreed that there are opportunities for them to progress in their job. So there are some serious gaps here in precisely the sorts of things that we know are most important to NHS staff and which lead them to feel valued and involved and engaged in their job. So my next question for you. We've had over a decade, as I said, of policy, which is about promoting staff engagement. The first chapter in this takes you through those policies in detail, what they've said, what they've tried to do, what the initiatives have been based on those policies. And we've still got a long way to go. So my question is this a case of increasing and intensifying current approaches? Is it we need to do more of what we're doing and we just need to do it and perhaps more consistently or in a more intensive way? Or do you think we need to rethink our approach to engaging staff altogether? Anyone want to hazard a, or not hazard is not a right answer, anybody want to share their thoughts on that?
Hang on, can we wait for Mike, please?
Sorry.
Thank you. It's okay. Thank you.
Wait,
Sorry, we have a culture in the NHS, I feel, and it's been inbred in us and instilled in us from when we were students, that you follow this example, you follow this rule, you follow this policy, and at the end of it, you'll come out with a job and a career and support from your managers. If you go against that, you lose that support mechanism, and suddenly you're seen as a bit of a maverick. Okay. So, to conform is the safest thing in an organisation.
Okay.
And I think the management deal out rules and regulations to protect sometimes the way that the organisations run.
Okay, thank you.
We've got two.
There's two behind. Oh, thank you for passing that over.
Thank you. I find that I can understand what you were just saying there. I can appreciate what you're saying, but I find it really disturbing if we have a general view that you keep your head down and because you have to. The culture is so strong that you have to conform, and any beliefs you might have had at the outset, well, you say goodbye to them, because I don't believe that. I believe you have to stand up for what you believe in. You have to question the guidelines. I mean, I've done that my whole career, always asked why, and always been the maverick, and it's not got me into any trouble. It's presented a lot of challenges, but it hasn't stopped my career progression at all. And if we, as a profession in midwifery, accept the status quo, we're lost. So we have to be, and I think this is what this is all about, leadership, isn't it? And we have to encourage somehow the people that we're leading to come with us. It's how we engage midwives and staff with us to move the service forward, and that means being very challenging.
Okay, thank you.
Are those figures broken down into different type of units? Because I've got quite a thing in my head. When I first started as a midwife, I worked in a place where there were 27 midwives and everybody knew each other.
Right.
Now the place I work, there's 200. Surely the size of the place, does that make a difference? Is there anything on the research there that are coming out of different units that people feel more valued in smaller places? Or
that's an interesting question. Certainly the staff survey findings are not broken down to a particularly detailed level, is my understanding, is they tend to be, you can disaggregate them to trust level, but I'm not sure that I know more about the patient survey, funnily enough, than the staff survey, but we still struggle with the patient survey to disaggregate to probably what is a meaningful level. I certainly know that some of the evidence around, I've got a bit of hiss, or
just give me a second.
I hope that's a bit better. Yes. I certainly know some of the evidence around, for example, employee-owned organisations shows it's much easier to gain forms of staff involvement and participation and kind of collaboration in a smaller organisation. And I guess for probably quite obvious reasons that you can do it much more easily when day-to-day contact is actually from a restricted number of people. I don't know how transferable that is into the NHS, but again, it's one of those things that I suppose intuitively we think would probably be correct, but I'm not sure of the research evidence behind that, but it's a very good point. Thank you.
Thank you. We've got one at the back first. Thank you.
I'd like to take up the previous speaker's point about service leadership and the clinical leadership that goes with that. I currently am based with the East of England, and there's an awful lot of regional as well as local work being done on driving services forward by clinical leadership and the campaigns for making a difference by individuals. I think one of the things that we are not good at generally is talent spotting and picking out the talents and mapping that against the needs of our organisation, and I think we've got a long way to go in that, and some of the early work is proving really fruitful in that. I think the other thing that needs to come off the back of that as well is coaching and mentorship.
Mm-hmm.
And these are all professional business terms that other organisations do very well, but the NHS doesn't. It's more bureaucratic in its nature. And taking down to that personal level and driving change from individuals within, because for me, I think every powerful change that's ever happened in my career, personally, and to my organisation has been driven by key individuals
okay.
that have led that through and owned it and made it happen.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to move on. I know some of you put your hands up, and I'm sorry to move on. I've only got 10 minutes, and I just want to say a little bit more about the work that we did. Thank you so much for sharing that with me, though. What I want to do is just very quickly talk about the report then, because our starting point, myself and my colleague Chris Ham, who I did this piece of work with, was we're not sure that more of the same is necessarily going to achieve the really high levels of staff engagement that we're seeking at the moment within the NHS. And we wanted to look at something quite radically different. And it's very much a think piece. It's intended to be a starting point for discussion rather than a worked out manifesto or sort of a set of ideas to simply be implemented. But what we wanted to look at was a very different employment model, which is one where employees are also co-owners. So you absolutely change the nature of the relationship between the NHS and its staff. The piece of work is called NHS Mutual. And what we do broadly is three things. We explore this rather kind of tormented concept of employee ownership. What does it actually mean? And we look at the whole spectrum of co-owned, fully employee-owned organisations, so which might be run on entirely democratic principles, so cooperatives might be a good example, through to sort of forms in the middle of kind of individual share ownership, through to at the other end sort of forms of just performance-related pay, so some sort of financial involvement which doesn't actually mean that you're an owner in any sense of the term. Of course, there are very fundamental issues here about what the basis and benefits of employee ownership might be in the NHS, in a public service, where a financial stake and a financial dividend aren't appropriate. And they certainly probably aren't the things that drove people to come into the service in the first place. So one of the things we do is explore what that basis might be and what those benefits might be. We include an example. It's currently the only employee-owned organisation in the NHS, which is Central Surrey Health. And we talk about how Central Surrey Health have achieved this. All their staff have a one penny share, so they have a sort of nominal stake in the organisation. And any surplus, they're a former PCT provider arm, by the way, any surplus that's generated from the organisation is reinvested into areas that are identified as priorities by their staff, who are called co-owners. So there's much more detail in the report about how this works in practice. What we also wanted to do was bring together some of the international evidence for employee ownership. Does it work? How does it work? When does it work? So we've gathered together quite a substantial evidence base about employee ownership and its impact on organisational outcomes, so productivity and performance in particular, but staff turnover, staff absence, innovation, on outcomes that matter to employees. So does employee ownership make for happier staff? But does it improve levels of satisfaction? Does it improve well-being? And all of those outcomes which are particularly valued by employees. And what sort of impact might employee ownership have on end-user outcomes? There's very little evidence on that at the moment, unfortunately. And then what we do, having brought all of that together, is consider the potential applicability of employee ownership models and staff partnership models, which are a sort of variant, to the NHS. So what did we find? The evidence base is substantial and it's fairly compelling, but it isn't largely UK-based. So there are issues about transferability of this evidence base, and I do need to make that clear. But employee-owned organisations tend to deliver a range of benefits above and beyond traditionally owned companies. In terms of organisational productivity, they tend to have much lower levels of staff turnover. So, for example, one of the few employee-owned organisations in the home care sector in the UK, Sunderland Home Care, has an annual turnover rate of about 4-5%, compared to a national sector average of about 20-24%, I believe. There tends to be much higher levels of employee well-being, and there's some emerging evidence now that employee-owned organisations, by putting employees more in control, are delivering higher levels of innovation. Thank you. What's important to say is that employee ownership by itself doesn't tend to deliver these benefits. So employee ownership does deliver them when it's combined with opportunities for staff to directly participate in decision-making, when staff have a voice in the organisation. And why it's mutually reinforcing is that employee-owned organisations are much more likely to introduce staff participation schemes, to introduce direct involvement in decision-making. And those schemes, that opportunity for participation is much more sustainable in employee-owned organisations. So what you tend to find in traditionally owned organisations is new schemes, new initiatives for staff to participate or introduce, but they tend to be scaled back or discontinued over time. That doesn't seem to be the case in employee-owned organisations. And what we then map out are a number of possible options for the NHS based on this evidence that we've gathered. At a minimum, we could argue that the NHS needs to look at more opportunities for staff to have voice in their organisations and for staff to shape their jobs, the services they deliver, the directions that their organisations are taking. And there's lots of evidence out there about what makes staff participation effective, which could be built into schemes as we move forward. So we know that they're much more likely to be beneficial and to produce positive outcomes if they give staff greater autonomy and control, which is something I heard earlier on. They're much more likely, staff participation schemes are much more likely to be beneficial if they're implemented in bundles and they're consistent. So it's no good giving staff influence and the ability to shape in one area if they're denied it elsewhere. The inconsistency undermines any benefits that can be seen. And perhaps something that we'd all understand as being correct is that they're much more likely to produce benefits if managers are visibly and actively supporting them. So there's a whole range of things we know about what makes participation more effective that could be implemented more consistently. But then there are some more radical suggestions that we look at. So, for example, staff, much greater staff control and autonomy within their own service units or directorates, for example, within foundation trusts. And certainly as we're looking for new organisational models for PCT provider arms, one of the potential menu of options there could be in that central Surrey Health model, an employee-owned community health service, for example. So are we likely to see NHS Mutual in the future? Well, certainly we've seen a lot of promotion of social enterprises from the Labour government, and emerging Conservative policy suggests they're also interested in mutual models. So I think we're likely to see a lot of this in manifestos, so that may be supportive. We also, as I said, have our first example of an employee-owned health service. This is Central Surrey Health. But there are a number of fundamental challenges which I think need to be considered before we move forwards on this. Is there the political will to actually take this forward? Is there the political will not only, for example, to support social enterprises, but to make sure that social enterprises emerge and are formed in a favourable environment where barriers and obstacles are removed? In this respect, pensions are likely to be a considerable sticking point. The government, at the time of the Darcy report, announced that staff transferring into social enterprises would be able to retain their NHS terms and conditions, including pensions. But that wouldn't be the case for staff joining social enterprises as a new employee. So there's still a fundamental issue here about how the pensions issue plays out in terms of social enterprise organisations. And there's some very practical issues about the financial and business support that we would need to give to organisations transferring into social enterprise or employee ownership. We talk a little bit in the report about Central Surrey Health and the journey that they took, and there are a number of very practical obstacles that would need to be overcome. And if you wanted to look any more at the report, and as I said, it is very much a sort of starting point for discussion, the report, the title and the authors are there. It can be accessed from both the HSMC website, so that's where I work, and from the Nuffield Trust. And as I said, I have some copies of the executive summary, which I'll leave at the front desk. Thank you.
Thank you, Jo. Thank you, Jo. Our next speaker is Martin Bradley. He is the Chief Nursing Officer for Northern Ireland.
and he's at the Department of Health, Social Service and the Public Safety. And Martin is responsible for advising the Minister and Department on all aspects of policy which affects nursing, midwifery and the allied health professional. He has an interest in community development and targeting health, social needs and primary care. He's also a visiting professor of nursing at the University of Ulster. Welcome, Martin. Not being a good chair here. Martin is going to do his talk, then he's going to invite questions and answer at the end of his talk. Thank you.
Well, on the back of that, I'm conscious I stand between you and your lunch. So I think really my bargain will be to really seriously finish at 10 past one, so you can have a proper break, unless you detain me 10 past one. Good afternoon. The first thing I want to say is, obviously, I'm not a midwife, but I do chair the Midwifery 2020 subgroup looking at the project on the public health role of midwives, and I'm very ably assisted by a whole range of midwives coming from a variety of different areas of professional practice. What I want to do this afternoon, just very quickly, is really give you a little bit of a feeling of where I'm coming from. And that's also against the background that in Northern Ireland we've had an integrated health and social care economy since 1972. So we've been trying to get this right for quite some time. And I'm not saying that we've got it completely right, but certainly there is more opportunities for more integration between health and social care in Northern Ireland because of the way in which the system is set up, and also because the funding streams are health and social care. There is not a separate budget as such for social care and for health. They are brought together, and then they are used by practitioners within the various programmes of care. I also need you, in actual fact, because I don't think there'll be much time for questions probably, to make the links in this presentation for yourselves, for your own professional practice, but also I think in the broader context for really the role that you play within the Royal College of Midwives, and also the role that you play within your own workplace, within your own local communities, and also within your own family, because I think what I've got to say has implications for all of that. So, the first thing I want to do is really start from a value base, and in Northern Ireland, these are the values that we've articulated for our healthcare system and social care system, something that, again, all of you will be very familiar with, and I doubt there's anybody within the room who wouldn't be able to sign up to all of these. But these are really the government's commitments in relation to health and social care within Northern Ireland. And when I say government, I mean the Northern Ireland Assembly, because health and social care is a devolved matter in all of the devolved countries now of the United Kingdom. Again, something once more that I'm sure you're very familiar with is a diagram from Whitehead in relation to the main determinants of health. And I'm just putting this up because I think we have to make the case that health and social care is not just something that is confined to health and social care professionals. It's not something that is just confined to midwives in this context. But at the same time, the real challenge here is about how do we make the links? How do we advocate for people, and how do we try to make those links into the other areas of public and social life within the United Kingdom, that if we could get our act together, we might actually begin to make a difference? And as you can see there, the big themes, the big messages are that public health and good life chances are around individual lifestyle factors, around social and community networks, around the big public spending agencies and how that money is spent and whether that is linked up and whether or not indeed there is a public health agenda in the way in which they approach their work. And then finally, of course, the general economic, social, cultural, environmental conditions within a country. And of course, that will be a very interesting thing to manage and to work our way through as the United Kingdom hopefully is going to come out of a recession. But it looks as if it's going to be a slow burn on the evidence so far. Before leaving that diagram, I just want you to focus on the very middle bit, because this is a very important piece, I think, in the sense of where your particular profession comes in the sense of the real opportunities that there are at the very beginning of life, and sometimes even before life has begun, at the preconceptual phase, in relation to interventions that we might think about making, and ways in which we might actually, in a sense, become more organized if we really want to make a difference to the next generation and make a real difference in pulling some of the very big public health levers that are still out there to be pulled. Again, if we take all of that seriously and try to translate that into practice, then the argument would go that this has to be about not doing things for people, but helping people to do a little bit more for themselves. And part of this, part of the trick here, I think, is about strengthening individuals, about strengthening communities, about improving infrastructure and access to services. And we know from all of the work around tackling health inequalities that access to better primary healthcare, social care services seems to be something that does make a difference. And also making some of the structural changes in our economy, cultural and environmental conditions that might actually help. Again, evidence coming out from North America that if we got better educational outcomes for our children, then we improve their life chances, we improve their health chances. Can be a sort of a difficult argument to sustain in a health context because it might actually suggest that if we spent a little bit more on education and supporting young people, then maybe we would have a better outcome for the next generation by doing something like that as opposed to trying to do the firefighting that very often we do in the health service. Just want to put this up. This is our public health strategy in Northern Ireland, Investing for Health. And again, it starts out really with a commitment within government that what we need to try and do is to bring all of our resources together so as we can make major improvements. Instead of everybody working in their own silo and looking after themselves and making absolutely sure that they get their whack of the budget, we actually need to see where we can actually share money so as we can begin to make a difference. And that's been backed up by investing in a healthier future, which has a range of strategic themes around investing for health and well-being. In other words, can we actually begin to put a little bit of water between trying to deliver a reactive service, a curative service, as opposed to a preventative service? How do we involve people? Rather than it just becoming a cliche, how do we actually get communities involved and individuals involved in relation to their health and social care? How do we get them to advocate more effectively for what they do? And what is the role of professionals within that? Developing teams which can deliver. One of the big emphases, as far as I can see this morning, has been around teamwork. And increasingly in modern health and social care, individuals who work just purely on their own can be a bit of a liability. So how do we actually get people networked, even if they are working much more on an individual level? How do we support responsive and integrated services, and also how can we improve the quality? This graph shows life expectancy in Northern Ireland. It's no different in other parts of the United Kingdom, and you can see two big inequalities here, one of which I'm more concerned about, which is a gender inequality. I have an abiding and personal interest as I get older to do something about that. But the other big inequality, of course, is the equality between the social classes. And the interesting thing about that diagram, which looks at life expectancy for 2006 to 2008, is the gap between a male living in some of the more deprived areas of Northern Ireland and a female living in some of the more affluent areas of Northern Ireland. And there is a gap there, a real gap of around about 10 plus years. The thing that I find slightly depressing about this diagram is that this survey has been carried out on 10-year intervals for the last 30 years, and the gap has not decreased. Now, if we as a health and social care system were being performance managed in the sense of a target, well, we would be losing at this point. Because if anything, the gap has increased over that period of time, not decreased. So for all of that expenditure of money, for all of that human effort, for all of that human endeavour, we still have quite a challenge. There is something that isn't quite working at the moment. Again, this is more to do with another paradigm, but just something to think about, and again, something for maybe you to think about. At the top of the graph, or at the top of the illustration, is how we currently very often deal with issues to do with health and social care. And it's about waiting around, waiting for things to happen, and then trying to put them right. The paradigm shift here is looking at ways in which we in the 21st century, as a society, as a community,
can actually maybe try to get ahead of the game, try to anticipate what is likely to happen. And with the developments in technology, particularly work coming out of the Human Genome Project, we are going to be much better positioned to actually begin to anticipate what is going to happen in a lifespan. But what are the big implications for practice? What are the big implications for your practice and for my practice if we begin to take that paradigm shift seriously? And it seems to me that it leads us into another paradigm. Again, at the top of the diagram, we have the traditional way of delivering health and social care, where we focus very much in a professional silo around tertiary, secondary, and primary care. But if we're moving into an information age of healthcare, then we have to ask ourselves, what opportunities does that open up? And is there more opportunity for actually engaging with populations around individual self-care, the involvement of friends and family, and trying to develop self-help networks? And again, in the context, I think, of your practice, you know, what would be a self-help network? What would be more innovative, dynamic engagement of friends and family? Is that appropriate in any areas of your practice? That's for you to answer. But is it a way forward in the sense of how we use our resources? And then you can see that the professional is being positioned in a slightly different way. The professional as a facilitator, the professional as a partner, and then, you know, when push comes to shove, the professional as an authority, in the sense that we must bring something to the show in the sense of our training and education and our clinical practice and our knowledge. As you know, everything has to be about patients and clients. But when you look at all of the healthcare, social care policies across the UK, this is the direction in which we are meant to be moving. And it's about a changing world. The only point I want to make there, really two points, is that we have to also get it into our heads that, you know, programs become more important than beds in the sense of how we actually deliver what we do. But also politicians have a job to do as well, because sometimes our politicians are somewhere else when it comes to how to describe a modern health and social care system in relation to what the infrastructure might look like, which is where politicians very often get caught. And it's a new way of delivering care, moving from the current view to an evolving model, which is much more participatory. Because if it isn't going to be participatory, then quite frankly, the system's doomed. We won't be able to afford it. It has to become more participatory. And again, another paradigm of moving from tertiary care, secondary care, even moving from primary care down to the whole idea of what self-care might mean in relation to resolution, alleviation, and in some cases, toleration. How do people live with the conditions that they find themselves in? But also, how does that become tolerable in the sense of having a reasonable quality of life, even though life is not perfect? Interesting piece of work, looking at WHO level in relation to what are going to be the major issues that will affect the populations in the developed world between now and 2020. And you can see what the burden of disease, the burden of illness is going to be, both for males and females. Now, interesting enough, you will see on the female side that mental health issues will be a considerable burden in relation to life chances. Bringing this down into a bit more of the reality of public health, child obesity is a problem. Do we have a role to play there? Those are just some statistics in relation to what it's like at the moment in Northern Ireland, but then Northern Ireland and the United Kingdom compared to some of the other countries around the world. Poor record in dental health. You can see again in the pink Northern Ireland, and you can see the United Kingdom, you can see England. But you can see Ireland there as well. Now, if you look at Ireland, Ireland is, I think, the second in from the right-hand side of that slide as you look at it. And then you can see Northern Ireland. Now, that's the one island of Ireland. Why do you think there's such a difference? Well, bearing in mind you're going to get your lunch in a minute, the difference is that in the Republic of Ireland, the water is fluoridated in the north of Ireland, it isn't. And, you know, there's lots of talk about putting medication into water supplies and all the rest of it, but the reality is that that's a very big public health lever that could be pulled if there was a will to do so. Again, along with the rest of the United Kingdom, high levels of young people drinking alcohol. Anybody from Wales? My prejudice had Scotland up there, but Wales are in the lead at the moment. And then the proportion of the population suffering from clinical asthma. You might be asking yourself, what has this got to do with midwives or with midwifery? But the reality is this is where people end up. And I'm just conscious of something that Frank Field, the Labour MP, said recently in an article in the Times when he was actually talking about inequality. So you need to understand the statement in that context. He made the point, in the United Kingdom, most children are born in hospital and then they go home. Now, he wasn't making a thing about home births. He was making a point about health inequalities. You know, we all start off more or less relatively equal and then we go home. If we're going to do something about this, then there is something about what we do in relation to women's health, but also in relation to child health. When you look at mortality rates, this is a graph showing mortality rates from 1841 to the year 2001. And all I really want to just point out to you is that health and environment and social care are linked. The graph, I think, makes the point without going any further. We also know from work being done in America, particularly in Harvard, that the very early years of life are really important to child development. And it's both a physiological issue as well as a mental development issue. And it is amazing the amount of activity that goes on in those very early months and years. And the pattern for the rest of life is set quite quickly. Is this an opportunity? Is it a missed opportunity? There's also a mismatch between investment and opportunity. There's the opportunity, and the investment has gone AWOL. It's gone somewhere else. You know, is that a matter for you guys? Is that a matter for me? Who talks about this or advocates? Who can produce the evidence? Who can make the argument as to where the money should go? Because the evidence is there. Again, in Northern Ireland, this is our Unicini model of thresholds, which we've developed with the review of school nursing and health visiting at the moment. But it's just making the very simple point that there are a range of interventions that can be done in a universal service, and then there are a range of interventions that need to be done when we can identify those people who are going to need extra help in our community. And if you look at some of the evidence about what is successful, we know that intensive approaches with individuals and with families does make a difference. It needs community commitment. We need to be flexible in how we do it. And we need to support the practitioners who are going to be doing that. And again, just a quotation from a piece of research which again, really, in many ways, I think, focuses on the fact that there are critical points at which to intervene. And if we miss those points, we miss an opportunity. I'm just banging on here. The other point I'd just like to leave you with is that nursing and midwifery is part of a political and a social system. You know, we have a real opportunity to make a difference if we get ourselves organised and if we choose to do so. And some of you, of course, do that very effectively. But we intrude into all aspects of public life in the United Kingdom, both because of our size, but also because of our knowledge and because of the way in which we conduct our business. But are we as effective as we could be? And it is about making it happen. It is about having a propensity towards action. You know, how do we use our knowledge? How do we use our knowledge of what's going on in the world around us, other than by who we vote into power? And finally, you know, this is life, I suppose. You're born, and things happen. Big things and small things, good things and not so good things. And you change. But you only get one chance at it. Thank you.